We're going to have a bit of a race this evening. Everybody, please open to the Song of Solomon. While you're turning, I'll just explain that model that you see on the screen there is at the visitor center for Megiddo, which, of course, lent its name to the famous word Armageddon. But Megiddo was the site of one of Solomon's great forts there in the north, very heavily fortified, a great storehouse also of supplies for the people, not just in military battles, but, you know, for other emergencies that might arise. And at that visitor center, when you go to visit Megiddo, they show the ruins themselves here, which you're able to walk in. So they're showing these little mounds that you see. There are actual walls that have been reduced to foundation level, but are the remains from the building that Solomon placed there. And then these lighter colored walls and structures are estimations of what it may have looked like at the time of Solomon. And so it's a really kind of a neat thing what they've done there. The Jewish people back in antiquity were not only great constructors, and we've seen many of these sorts of models, particularly of Jerusalem, the temple, and whatnot, but also tunnelers. And there is, at this location, one of the more interesting and larger of the tunnel systems that had been built in antiquity for various purposes. Water collection is one of the major ones, but also for the defense of the city and storage again, cooler in the summers and that sort of thing, which you can't quite see in this picture. I'll show you the second one. There's a large pit right here, which has a circular staircase that goes down, built out of rock inside, that is a part of Solomon's original structure as well, and leads out on the far side of the hill here to a location where the tunnel exits the side of this hill on the back side. And so what they've done here with these buttons in the front is you come up to this model, you push these buttons, they've got an explanation of what it is, and then they will elevate various structures and give you an explanation of what they were, and in some cases, of course, that reveals something about the underground structure too. Farrell Jenkins and I had chartered a private flight, just the two of us and the pilot in a small plane. And this is Megiddo from the air in 2011. Farrell snapped this particular picture. And so if I can go back here to the model, I forgot to show you one thing, but I'm going the wrong way again. Okay, in the model, please notice this grand entryway right here, which is slope, ramp, so they can be able to bring animals in, towing carts, you know, for heavier supplies and whatnot, coming through what was the main entrance gate to the city. As you look at that area, that entryway, this is that entryway right there, which would be coming into the main entrance to the city of Megiddo then. And now you can see this large pit here in which you go down quite a very great depth, and then you'll see cisterns that are carved out there still holding water, and eventually work your way out through the hillside to the tunnel exit there where the buses will meet you, you know, when you leave. But I bring all this up because the scripture reading that James so capably presented to us a moment ago was hopefully kind of tying three things together all at once. We have been, of course, studying the book of Ecclesiastes. We've been looking at the Solomon's wisdom there, and have been appreciating then that one of the great blessings that he has presented in this life is a happy marriage. That is particularly the scripture that in the latter part of what James had read. But it began with the statement that we will all be forgotten. And so I was tying in the bulletin article that I wrote for this morning's bulletin as well. In between these two, we are also studying on Sunday nights then the Song of Solomon, which is apparently his magnum opus song, which I believe was intended to be presented as a play to the people of his time 3,000 years ago. He is presenting then the glory, the joy, the happiness of a truly great and good marriage. And so what you have is one of the wealthiest men of all time, the wisest man of all time, the scripture identifies him, one of the great architects and builders of all the Jewish history's time, singing the praises of marriage in the Song of Solomon, in exhorting us in his book of Ecclesiastes, after all of his experiences, you know, that for those of us who marry and have happy marriages, this is truly a great reward from our God. And then, never forget, you die and will be totally forgotten. Okay? And this is not a bad thing. It is the way the world works. And so to this day, nobody knows Solomon. You know, nobody knew him personally or anything. We have only the tiniest vestiges 3,000 years later of this man. And one day, he too, you know, the last bits of even such structures as this will be gone. Now, we've been looking at the Song of Solomon, and as I've suggested, this would be an outline of a play in these several scenes. And we have come to the very middle of the book, having seen in these 27 verses last week, his wedding. Solomon now has married the young woman that has been the principal singer throughout the early going of the book, and they have been discussing their original meeting and her becoming a part of the harem before they're married. A courtship that takes place now that she has been singled out as a worthy possibility for marriage of Solomon himself. And then there has been a dream scene in chapter 3, verses 1 through 5, in which she sings of her great love for him. And then the wedding that we saw last week. And that, I think that's like 63 verses or something. I forget exactly what it is. At this point, we have 61 verses to go. And so it's taken us 3 weeks to get this far, the first half, but tonight we're going to finish the whole book. We'll take the whole last half here tonight, because the song has established itself now, and we are going to be seeing a little bit of repetition, if you will, almost like a chorus, you know, a refrain. And so we'll be able to go a little bit faster here. I think we'll wrap the book up tonight. As long as you remember that in chapter 5, verse 2, through chapter 6, verse 3, we have, like suggesting, as I read in the commentary many years ago, a nightmare scene in which this young woman, now very happily married to Solomon, you know, is expressing in song and in the play by means of a nightmare scene, what it would be for her to lose this man, to be unable to find him. So she goes through a kind of a night terror thing, which is a means or a device by which, you know, her love is still being extolled, her love for him is being extolled in this particular scene. Then you have chapter 6, verse 4 through 8, chapter 8, verse 4, these lovers in their older years, the happily married, and again singing the praises of each other and how much they love each other, to conclude with a few verses in chapter 8, verse 5 through the end of the book at verse 14, of them being apparently at the very end or toward the very end of their lives, and now they in the chorus looking back at how this cycle goes on and on and on. And so now, a very young, prepubescent girl is introduced, and the cycle is going to be starting all over again. It appears to be a very artful way in which Solomon now is presenting, not just that marriage is a wonderful and a good thing, but that we are all only a part of an endless cycle, which he's been telling us in the book of Ecclesiastes is endlessly repeating. And his constant refrain that all is vanity or futility and striving after wind is not so totally helpless as people often think. It is the recognition and in wisdom the presentation of the fact. And it helps us to be humble, to accept our place in life, whatever circumstances come to us in life, and just recognize them. Even the greatest of all kings cannot live forever. Even the greatest of all marriages cannot live forever. We will, all of us, eventually live out our days, come to the end, go into the earth, and be forgotten by the world. Solomon, in all of these books, is helping us to appreciate in Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and the Song of Solomon that he had seen it all. And let there be, then, no arrogance in us. Let there be no foolishness in us. And let there be no impatience or unhappiness in us if, by means of these three books, we can all accept that you can't win against nature. This is the way the world works. But you can be happier in the midst of the lifetime that you have, regardless of the circumstances that you find yourself in, if you learn to enjoy and to benefit from those good things that God gives us from His hand. And so hopefully tonight, kind of tying all those things together, we'll leave the Song of Solomon behind. We finished Proverbs here over a year ago, and shortly with another few chapters, we'll be finishing up the book of Ecclesiastes on Wednesday nights as well. Which reminds me that I appreciate Mark Dahl's going to be teaching the teen class. We're on newcomer. We'll be taking the responsibility for the invitation on Sunday the 24th. I still need a teacher for the Wednesday night class on May 27th. So if you'd like to teach that class May 27th, by all means, please let me know after the assembly here tonight. And with all that introduction said, let me get out of here. We'll have no more slides. Let's open up then to the Song of Solomon, mostly tonight, since, as I say, there's somewhat of a repetition now that's taking place. Won't need as much commentary. We'll have mostly a lot of reading, I think, and you'll see how this plays out in a self-explanatory manner. So we're going to start at chapter 5 and verse 2, which is apparently a nightmare scene, as you'll see it develop. And the first singer here in this scene is this young bride, now in the middle of their marriage, but the wife now in verse 2 of chapter 5. I was asleep, but my heart was awake. Well, apparently that's a dream. And then a great exclamation, apparently a voice. My beloved was knocking. So in the dream, she hears him knocking at the door. And then it's kind of hard to point this out, but I think she is still singing, but she is singing the words that her husband has presented. Open to me, my sister, my darling, my dove, my perfect one, for my head is drenched with dew, my locks with the damp of the night. And so for some reason, he is in this dream and this nightmare depicted as being outside the house. He now wants to come in. It's nighttime. He's damp then, from the night. And so he's calling out, let me in. In verse 3, she says that she was in bed. She was prepared for bed already. I've taken off my dress. How can I put it on again? I've washed my feet. How can I dirty them again? I've already gone to bed. My beloved extended his hand through the opening. My feelings were aroused for him. So imagine kind of a lattice there at the door. I arose to open to my beloved, and my hands dripped with myrrh, and my fingers with liquid myrrh. On the handles of the bowl, I opened to my beloved, but my beloved had turned away and had gone. So apparently in this dream scene, by the time she did get up, and she dressed, and she's now going to go and let him in, I opened, but now he turned away. My heart, verse 6 in the middle, went out to him as he spoke. I searched for him, but I did not find him. I called him, but he did not answer me. The watchmen who make the rounds in the city found me. They struck me and wounded me. The guardsmen of the walls took away my shawl from me. So apparently, they're abusing her. And it's not a horrifying thing. It sounds like they're mistreating her maybe in the way that men might do, in a cruel but sort of a joking manner. But they have wounded her to some extent. They've stolen the shawl away from her. And then she says, I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem. Who are they in the play? That's the chorus. I adjure you, I appeal to you, if you find my beloved, as to what you will tell him. For I am lovesick. So that's what this is. It is, in the play, the presentation of a nightmare scene, a dream scene, in which she is just destitute and is mistreated in this dream, but it's an artifice by which her great love is being sung. And so now, in the dream, she's appealing to the chorus, to tell her husband that she's lovesick. And they say in verse 9, what kind of beloved is your beloved, O most beautiful among women? What kind of beloved is your beloved that thus you adjure us? So why are you asking us to tell him how much you love him? What kind of guy would that be?
You see, brethren, why I strongly suggest, and it wasn't my original idea, but I'm agreeing with the commentary, Kyle Deuce, as a matter of fact, first suggested it in my experience anyway, that all of this is designed as a public play to sing about the glory of marital life, and all of it designed with various different scenes in the play. And these three principal characters, the chorus being one character, if you will, to have a means simply of alternating back and forth of seeing how great it is to be in love, how much you appreciate this other person. So now, starting at verse 10, she's going to do what he had been doing for her previous scene. He had been singing about her beauty. She now, singing back to the chorus, is singing of his beauty. So, in verse 10, my beloved is dazzling and ruddy, outstanding among 10,000. His head is like gold, pure gold. His locks are like clusters of dates and black as a raven. His eyes are like doves beside streams of water bathed in milk and reposed in their setting. His cheeks are like a bed of balsam, banks of sweet-scented herbs. His lips are lilies, dripping with liquid myrrh. His hands are rods of gold set with beryl. His abdomen carved ivory, inlaid with sapphires. His legs are pillars of alabaster, set on pedestals of pure gold. At this point, every husband says, yeah, my wife says that kind of stuff to me all the time. Yes, sure. Okay. And finally, in 15, his the middle, his appearance is like Lebanon. Choice is the cedars. His mouth is full of sweetness. He is wholly desirable. This is my beloved, and this is my friend, O daughters of Jerusalem. Well, was there ever such a guy? Was there ever such a woman as he had been singing, earlier? It is all the elaborate and, extreme hyperbole, of love. And the love songs of today and of yesterday and tomorrow do exactly the same thing, don't they? Okay? Sing in all kinds of extreme ways how much, I love so-and-so. A popular theme of which is, if ever you leave me, if we break up, I shall die. I can't live without you. It would be impossible. I'm utterly, I'm destroyed. And yet, brethren, husbands and wives die every day, don't they? And what happens? You go on without them. Nobody has died. For being lovesick, to my knowledge, there are very few, at least. It's hyperbole. But it makes the point. And it's beautiful, and so we appreciate it. It is extreme. It's an exaggeration. It's not real, but it is a way of saying, when I think of how precious you are to me, have to invent comparisons that are crazy. What an abdomen, inlaid with sapphires, for Pete's sake. But, it's just, that's how much you mean to me. So the chorus comes back to chapter 6 and verse 1. Where is your beloved gone, O most beautiful among women? Where is your beloved turned, that we may seek him with you? And so, as this nightmare continues, in verse 2, though, she somehow has an idea where he's gone. My beloved has gone down to his garden, to the beds of balsam, to pasture his flock in the gardens and gather lilies. I am my beloved's, and my beloved is mine, he who pastures his flock among the lilies. And so once again, it's just a way of saying, I'm destitute without him, I'm totally unhappy, I'm abused by everybody about me, mistreated by the very guards of the city that should be taking care of me. This is how I feel when I'm not with him. And he's out there pasturing his flocks among the lilies. It's just this idyllic setting. Now, in the outline, if you want to make a note in your Bible here, suggests then that their mature love is going to be now discussed in chapter 6, verse 4, through chapter 8, verse 4. So,
all of it about love, all of it about the stages of love, from their first meeting, their courtship, through their marriage, the unmarried life, now the middle of that married life in chapter 6, verse 4 through 8, 4. And now Solomon sings. They're alternating back and forth. Or in the Song of Solomon, whoever that male lead is, verse 4 of chapter 6. You are as beautiful as Tirzah, my darling, great city, as lovely as Jerusalem, as awesome as an army with banners. Turn your eyes away from me, for they have confused me. Your hair is like a flock of goats that have descended from Gilead. He'd already used that expression once. Your teeth are like a flock of ewes which have gone up from their washing, all of which bear twins, and not one among them has lost her young. Your temples are like a slice of pomegranate behind your veil. There are 60 queens and 80 concubines and maidens without number. But my dove, my perfect one, is unique. She is her mother's only daughter, the pure child of the one who bore her. The maidens saw her and called her blessed. The queens and the concubines also, and they praised her, saying, who is this that grows like the dawn, as beautiful as the full moon, as pure as the sun, as awesome as an army with banners? I went down to the orchard of nut trees to see the blossoms of the valley, to see whether the vine had budded or the pomegranates had bloomed. Before I was aware, my soul set me over the chariots of my noble people. So, Solomon is singing about how he has come to be king over the whole land. And she is not his only wife, she is not his only concubine, but she's the best of the bunch. And one of the very rare places where we might conceivably, possibly, maybe begin to think that this would have been written not at the very end of his life, but maybe somewhere, you know, in the middle. Seeing that, we learn he has many more wives and concubines in the historical books. At this point in verse 8, he says there are how many? 60 queens and 80 concubines and maidens without number. And so, you know, maybe not at the very end of his life when this particular book had been written. It's hard to know, you know, for sure there either. It's all stylized, it's all idealized, it's all, you know, mythical and fantastical, and so it may have just been, you know, a statement that doesn't necessarily reflect the actual circumstances. Not sure there. But what is it? Well, time is passing and life is going on and their marriage and their love is unabated and actually growing. And then, in verse 13, as a way of again portraying how beautiful this girl is, the first half of verse 13 is the chorus singing, come back, O Shulamite, come back, that we may gaze at you. Followed by the Solomon character singing, why should you gaze at the Shulamite as at the dance of the two companies? How beautiful are your feet in sandals, O prince's daughter. The curves of your hips are like jewels, the work of the hands of an artist. Your navel is like a round goblet which never lacks mixed wine. Your belly is like a heap of wheat fenced about with lilies. Your two breasts are like two fawns, twins of a gazelle. Your neck is like a tower of ivory. Your eyes are like the pools in Heshbon by the gate of Bath-Rabbim. Your nose is like the tower of Lebanon which faces toward Damascus. Your head crowns you like Carmel, and the flowing locks of your head are like purple threads. The king is captivated by your tresses. How beautiful and how delightful you are, my love, with all your charms. Your stature is like a palm tree, and your breasts are like its clusters. I said, I will climb the palm tree. I will take hold of its fruit stalks. Oh, may your breasts be like clusters of the vine, and the fragrance of your breath like apples, and your mouth like the best wine. Well, again, at this point in the song, it's just back and forth as they describe their love, and particularly, as I say, it makes us nervous, you know, in very, you know, overt physical terms. Not our cultural way, was it their time, so not anything, you know, that they should be faulted for here, but, you know, just not our way. Now, one very interesting thing, and nobody knows for sure, brethren, but still make a footnote here, that this Shulamite expression in chapter 6, verse 13, just drives all the scholars nuts. You know, what is that? And some of you will have Shunemite or Shunamite, S-H-U-N-E or N-A, mite. Now, like Israelite, when you've got this ite or mite on the end, that would suggest place of birth. And Shunem was a city in Israel, though quite small at the time. So maybe it is a reference to where she came from. But I kind of doubt it, because it is equally possible to translate or transliterate this word with the L instead of the M. And it becomes Shulamite rather than Shunamite, which is an N, I guess. Okay, Shulamite. And then, what I always wanted you to know is that Solomon is a word that can be translated and means peace. Shulamite is a word that can be translated and means peace. In other words, Solomon and Shulamite are the masculine and feminine ways of saying peace. And so I'm rather thinking what likely happened here was, again, it's a poetic device in which they've used the term and contrasting it with Solomon, the Song of Solomon, to show that in such a perfectly happy, well-suited, blissful marriage, there is peace. The chorus is singing about it, Solomon's singing about it, the woman is singing about it, the wife is singing about it. You know, all of this is about that great joy, that bliss. So maybe that. And if not that, you know, maybe a reference to a city, but today, you know, lost in antiquity. So we just don't know. All right, now, continuing in the middle of this, you know, later love or mature love scene, now, at the middle of verse 9, the wife sings again. He has said, your mouth is like the best wine. In the first part of 9, she responds, it goes down smoothly for my beloved, flowing gently from the lips of those who fall asleep. I am my beloved's, and his desire is for me. Come, my beloved, let us go out into the country. Let us spend the night in the villages. Let us rise early and go to the vineyards. Let us see whether the vine is budded and its blossoms have opened, whether the pomegranates have bloomed. There I will give you my love. The mandrakes have given forth fragrance, and over our doors are all choice fruits, both new and old, which I have saved up for you, my beloved. Oh, that you were like a brother to me, who nursed at my mother's breasts. If I found you outdoors, I would kiss you. No one would despise me either. I would lead you and bring you into the house of my mother who used to instruct me. I would give you spiced wine to drink from the juice of my pomegranates. Let his left hand be under my head and his right hand embrace me. And now for the third time in verse 4, as I pointed out last week, we get this refrain, apparently from Solomon. I want you to swear, O daughters of Jerusalem, do not arouse or awaken my love until she pleases. So, apparently, in this scene, we have these lovers now with some years behind them. They've been married for quite some time, and they still like to take long walks together. They still like to go for car rides in the country, you know, with the chariots in those days. They want to go out to the vineyards. They want to go out, you know, and see the pomegranates are blooming, and, you know, these sort of, they just cannot get enough of each other. Until we come down to chapter 8 and verse 1, which usually kind of crosses people's eyes at first, you know, in those next couple of verses. What is that all about? But I think really, it's the very thing that I said to Donna myself, you know, several times, but not quite exactly the same terminology. But, you know, I did not meet her until 1974, September of 74, in Denver, Colorado. And I was 22, and she was 20. And I said, time and time again, I wished I had known her
for those previous 20 years too. Because the fact of the matter is, I can't get enough of this woman. I love this woman. I wish, when I see pictures of her as a kid, I wish I could have been there. And I think that's what she's saying. I wish we had grown up together in the same family. I wish you'd been my brother. Because I just can't be happy, you know, if I'm not with you. And I feel robbed of those years that we didn't know each other. Brethren, this is what marriage can and should be. Just endlessly taking peace and pleasure each in the other's company. It is a truly magnificent and beautiful song. It's the song of songs. Apparently Solomon himself thinking the best that he had done. And with that declaration in verse 3, now let her sleep. We're exhausted from the day. We've been all over the countryside. You know, our love has been, you know, 100% of our waking moments. And now she passes again into slumber, and we had a dream scene, we had a nightmare scene. You know, each of these scenes ends, apparently, with, let's say, the curtain drawing, you know, night is falling, and to sleep they go. And that brings us then to the final scene in the book, chapter 8, verse 5 through 14. First, speaking, and similar to a refrain we had on the wedding day, is the chorus in the first part of chapter 5, or excuse me, verse 5. Who is this coming up from the wilderness, leaning on her beloved? Okay, we've had that. Who is this coming up from there and such? Okay, so it looks like the curtain opens, the chorus sings, yet we've gone from what was probably, you know, the fading tones of going to sleep, the song slowing down, it's quieting down, you know, and we close that last scene. And so the curtain's closed, everybody runs around, you know, and then the curtain opens, and what do you get? Sunrise, you know, new scene, who is this? You know, and we start another one of these days, another one of these scenes. Who's this coming up from the wilderness, leaning on her beloved? And Solomon, or the male lead, then says, beneath the apple tree I awakened you. There your mother was in labor with you. There she was in labor and gave you birth. Put me like a seal over your heart, like a seal on your arm, for love is as strong as death. Jealousy is as severe as Sheol. Its flashes are flashes of fire, the very flame of the Lord. Many waters cannot quench love, nor will rivers overflow it. If a man were to give all the riches of his house for love, it would be utterly despised. That really is a great crescendo, you know, in the book there. And then I'm a bit at a loss here as what follows in 8 through 14, not quite able to tell myself if this might be a child of this couple or if it is just some unrelated young girl who is now being, you know, introduced at the end here for reasons we'll see in a moment. But suddenly the chorus is apparently singing in verses 8 and 9 about this little sister. So who's the little sister? Well, I don't know. We, the chorus apparently is singing, we have a little sister. Well, is the chorus, you know, can't all of them have the same sister, I guess? Is it the child they're thinking about now, you know, from their marriage? Is it somebody else? You know, who is it? I don't know. But this girl appears in verse 8. We have a little sister. She has no breasts. So, prepubescent. What shall we do for our sister on the day when she is spoken for? Now, we're looking ahead now for someday some young man will want to marry her. Verse 9. If she is a wall, we shall build on her a battlement of silver. But if she's a door, we shall barricade her with planks of cedar. And you'll, huh? You know, what's that about?
What I think really clearly it's about is maybe hard for us to relate to if we don't talk about people this way, but we have similar, I think, or very different kinds of comparisons that we use, similes that we use.
what they're saying is, what should we do for this little girl and about her moral values? Will she be disciplined and strong and pure and righteous? A wall that we'll depict as having battlements of silver. Or, she can resist it in that case, you know, he advances. Or, is she like a door and, you know, just ought to be protected then? What kind of a character is she going to have? Now, every young man, as well as every young woman, it takes the form of the woman right here, is confronted with temptation in their life. You are confronted with puppy love and young love and all kinds of crushes. And certainly, as you pass through your years of puberty and beyond, you're going to be meeting guys and gals of all different kinds, you know, of moral persuasion. What you want for this young girl is that she is a wall. That girl knows where she stands. And she knows how to draw a line that says no farther. And if so, if she is that kind of an upright, pure, righteous, moral, you know, wholesome girl, then battlements of silver. She's just so beautiful. But if not, if she's easy like a door, well then, we shall barricade her with planks of cedar.
Yeah, you heard the old joke, you know, I wish we could take a kid when they become 13 years old and just put them in a barrel and nail on the top and bring them out again when they're 22. You've all heard that, you know, 12 years in between we don't want to deal with. Well, yeah, they're difficult years, and the kids are starting to strike out on their own and all that, and I suspect that's what that all is all about.
It is now this contemplative couple, and the purpose of the songwriter, and the purpose of the play, for us now to reflect on a lifetime of a very perfectly happy marriage. But now we're looking back at some future generation, whether they take it as their own child or whatever. You know, we're looking now in the cycle that's going to begin again. We need to protect that girl if she hasn't developed, you know, her moral values yet. If she has, then we'll celebrate her for her virtue. And this, apparently being the bride, and this becomes a third or a fourth possibility, is maybe it was, you know, a sequence where he went back to her own birth. But she says, I think, is saying, as we look at this little sister and this other girl, now I'm going to tell you what I was like. And the wife says, I was a wall, and my breasts were like towers. Then I became in his eyes as one who finds peace. There's that peace frame again. Solomon had a vineyard at Baal Haman. He entrusted the vineyard to caretakers. Each one was to bring 1,000 shekels of silver for its fruit. My very own vineyard is at my disposal. 1,000 shekels are for you, Solomon, and 200 are for those who take care of its fruit. O you who sit in the gardens, my companions are listening for your voice. Let me hear it. Hurry, my beloved. Be like a gazelle or a young stag on the mountains of spices. And the song ends. The play comes to a close, final conclusion.
Final curtain, you know, closes. And apparently, you know, it's a contemplative scene where she says, I did it right. 3,000-year-old culture, very different than ours, you know, and all these translations that we have to go through, the things being done very differently 3 millenniums ago.
But what she's saying is, I did it right. And what the song is intended to do is to say, and if you will, you can't imagine the joy that you will know. Your entire life will be exactly what I had James read in Ecclesiastes chapter 9. The joy of a married couple that has a long and happy life together, which again, with the introduction of the word in verse 11, Solomon, and at the end of verse 10, the actual word peace is saying, if you read it, want to have that peaceful life, that free from care and worry, that life that's just absolutely blissful, then do it this way. Be a disciplined, upright, moral young woman who finds the love of her life. He will likewise be a disciplined and upright and moral young man. You will marry, you will love each other, and then you will hope that you can teach the little sister and the others that come along, and you'll come to the end of your life, this is the way things ought to be. Trust us. Been there. Know what we're talking about. Do it this way. You'll be happy. Okay?
There's any comment or question?
Tough.
I got a lot of comments and questions in there, too. Myself, don't really, of course. You know, feel free to ask. But that'll tie up for us, the Song of Solomon. Remember, I still do need a volunteer to teach on Wednesday the 27th.
And with that, as always, I want to offer the invitation and opportunity to request prayer for the Bible study. If there might be, and I think I know everybody here, there would not be, you know, one who wanted to become a Christian this evening, then by all means, let it be so as we stand and sing.